Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, April 16th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. Before we dive into this week's show, I want to thank one of the sponsors of Talk Nerdy, Waterline by Israel New Tech. Waterline is a really cool podcast. It's created to communicate all the facets of water you can think of, technology, development, and sustainability. It's there so that we can learn more about water, about why we can't afford to lose water. And it's got a lot of really interesting episodes, like about urban water distribution, sustainable water management, regulation, and more. And guys, you can listen to Waterline by searching Waterline Podcast on iTunes or in your Android podcast app. I highly recommend it. All right, guys, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week. You know that Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. It's very important to me that the model remains the same. And the best way that I can support my show, other than through advertising, is through patronage of individuals like yourself. The easiest is to go to patreon.com/talknerdy. Maybe you're already on Patreon. And it's a great site where you can support a lot of different individuals who are creators. You know, maybe you want to support an artist, a graphic artist, or a musician, or a podcaster, or somebody who has a radio show. There's all sorts of different really, really cool creators on Patreon. And they help you split up whatever you want to pledge every month so that it goes to all of the people that you really care about. You can set limits. It's very easy. You just go to patreon.com/talknerdy if you want to support the show. And as part of the package, I give a shout out each week to those of you who are supporting at the highest levels. And that includes Phil T-Bear, the Zombie Drummer, love the name, David J. E. Smith, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jonathan Wright, the Honorable Husband, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you guys so, so very much for your support. All right, this week's a good one. I know I say that every week, but it really is. It's a good one. I sit down with Dr. Lona Frank. Now, Lona is a journalist and an author. She's also got her PhD in neurobiology, and she lives in Denmark. She writes a lot in Denmark, but of course her books have wide reach, and she's got a brand new book, and it's a fascinating read, you guys. Read. Ha, that's how you say that. It's a fascinating read, you guys. It's called The Pleasure Shock, The Rise of Deep Brain Stimulation and Its Forgotten Inventor. Right? I know. So we're going to dive deep, no pun intended, into that right now. So without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Lona Frank. Well, Lona, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
So you are visiting from Denmark right now.
Yes.
And you're working on other projects, but I'm very lucky that I was able to snag you for an hour and talk about your new book, which, as of the day of the recording, comes out today.
It does.
That's so exciting. Yeah. And so what that means is that today, bookstores have it on the shelf, and today is when places like Amazon actually ship the pre-orders that people have put in for.
Exactly.
Okay. But in terms of, I know with book sales and things like that, the pre-orders, I'm learning this because we just recently wrote a book, but the pre-orders all contribute to the first week sales.
Right.
Yeah. So that's super important, right? To try and get that going.
I don't even want to look.
That's probably smart not to be checking it all day. I could see that getting like obsessive. And so this is obviously, it's an English language book that is published in the US.
Yeah.
Did you already write a version previously, or is this your first? Like, how did that work, you deciding to have an English American publisher?
Well, when you live in a country of 5 million people, Denmark, and your language is Danish and 5 million people speak it, it's a little, I mean, it would be a little strange just to write for Danes. Mm-hmm. And this is so much an American story.
Yeah.
So I did, of course, write a Danish version. It's a little different from this. And then I went out, did the whole thing with, you know, a proposal, got an American publisher, and it will, you know, it's now coming out here. It'll come out in, you know, Japanese soon, and hopefully other languages.
Did it come out in Denmark first, or is it simultaneous? Yeah. Oh, it did. Yeah. Okay. Neat. And so, yeah, I guess that is smart. I never would have thought about the fact, because I grew up in the States. The
sure.
States
yeah.
is our market, you know, but I exactly. never would have thought about the fact that, like, yeah, if you actually want to sell enough copies to, like, make some money, you might have to try and spread out. And of yeah. course, your English is flawless, but is this common in Denmark?
Well, I wouldn't say flawless, but I would say that a lot of Danes or a lot of Europeans speak English mm-hmm. fairly well.
I don't detect an accent.
You know, we have just been watching too much American TV. That's the thing.
No, your English really is flawed. Like, you could have a broadcast American accent, which might be an insult to you. But.
Well, I do have a Danish broadcast, so maybe I should just change languages.
There
I don't know.
You go. You could simulcast.
Yeah.
So you do a radio show.
I do. It's a weekly one-hour show on one of the main Danish radio stations, and it's of course also podcast. Mm-hmm. And it's called 24 Questions for the Professor. So I basically invite academics that I think are doing interesting work and sit them down and talk about that work and their fields for an hour. So
yeah. That's fascinating. And from all different fields?
All different fields. I will have a psychologist one day, then a cosmologist, then an archaeologist. Could be anyone.
You know, it's funny. I was recording before you came in. I was recording with my friend Ali Ward doing my 200th episode, which will have aired by the time this goes to air. And she has a podcast called Ologies, and she interviews a different ologist each week,
right.
which is like a really interesting yeah. approach to it. It's a bummer, though, because sometimes she'll meet somebody who's really interesting and she can't figure out how to make them into an ologist. So right. she can't right. interview right. them for the show. You and I, we go a little bit more broad. But what I got to ask, like, before we even get into the book and the fascinating story that you tell, what is it about science that makes you want to have that focus? Because I know that for me, it's the most interesting thing there is, but it's also, unfortunately, still, I think, in the general world, considered a bit of a niche or niche.
Yeah. And that's unfortunate. That is something I've talked about in Denmark for a long time, that it ought not to be a niche.
Yeah.
I mean, science is not a thing by itself out there in the corner, nerdy stuff. It's culture.
Yeah.
It is culture. It is very much what affects our culture and affects how we think about ourselves and the world. So, I mean, I think science should not be treated as this, you know, nerdy, interesting topic. It has its own little place in the newspaper or mm-hmm. its own little show here and there. No, it should be everywhere in the yeah. news and in, you know, coverage of the world, because it is in everything.
It's foundational.
It is. And that was, you know, that was basically my reason for getting out of science. As I did my PhD, I worked as a neurobiologist for a while. I was going to have a career in, you know, the biotech industry. I had a job secured. And then I just, you know, said, no, I'm not going to sit there the rest of my life. I have to communicate about this stuff. I have to get out there and reflect on it and, you know, write about it and make this sort of, what I think is really interesting about science is the effects of science.
Mm-hmm.
It's not doing the experiment. It's really seeing the effects, thinking about what it means for us. So I just started, you know, a career as a science communicator instead.
Ah, I love that. I love your story. I love that you are one of the, it's interesting when I talk to other people in SciComm, because this is, you know, my world and these are a lot of my friends, and they all come from different paths. Sometimes you have people who studied academic journalism and then mm-hmm. they fell in love with science. Sometimes yeah. you have people who were scientists who decided that they liked stepping outside of the insular kind of fence and doing
sure.
the outreach more. And then you have people, you know, came at it from all sorts mm-hmm. of different angles. Some people, non-academic people, don't even have college degrees, which I think is incredible. But it's still a rarity a little bit for an individual to have gone all the way through and busted their ass to finish the PhD and do,
yeah.
you know, it's like, I've had friends who were definitely all but dissertation who are like, I just can't do it.
Yeah.
But to go through and basically have even a job lined up and at the last minute be like,
yeah,
I like this other aspect better.
Yeah.
Especially knowing that, especially when you start as a science communicator, it's not very secure.
Not at all.
Economically.
Not at all.
Yeah. Like you have to yeah. really work to make it a viable career.
Yeah. I did all sorts of things for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I landed this amazing job at a Danish newspaper called The Weekend Paper, which is sort of a highbrow kind of halfway New Yorker thing, but in broadsheet. Mm-hmm. And I've been there ever since. And this is 19 years.
Oh, so you have a staff position along with doing the radio show and writing.
And the books. And, yeah.
And so what, like, how many books have you written at this point?
Five.
Oh. Okay, tell me about the other four before we get into this one.
Well, the first two are not in English. Mm-hmm. They were sort of, they tried to debate the European reluctance to get into biotech many, many years ago. And then the first one that came out in English was Mindfield, which is about how brain science actually affects our way of seeing ourselves. Then there was My Beautiful Genome, which was out in 2011, I think, which is all about personal genomics, what you get from it, what it tells you about, especially, you know, your personality, who you are, who you can become, that sort of thing. And from that, we did a documentary called Genetic Me, which actually won a AAAS prize.
Oh, as, very cool. Know,
best documentary, science documentary that year. And now it's the new one is The Pleasure Shock.
Which is quite different. And of course, so it's really neat too that you approach SciComm from multiple angles, writing, doing the audio side of it with the radio show, and also producing film because it is just so important to tell these stories. Different stories, I think, lend themselves to different media better, but also there's something about the individual experience. Like some people don't listen to podcasts.
Oh, sure.
Or they don't listen to radio. It doesn't speak to
them.
And
tons of people actually don't read.
Yeah. And you're right. So, tons of people don't read. Yeah. And sometimes the visual media is the only way to reach out to somebody. So it's so great that you, even though it's probably incredibly time consuming and some of these aspects of it might come easier than others.
Sure.
I think it's
worth doing different things. I mean, I would feel sort of trapped if I was only writing all the time. I would be really bored. I have to break out of the mold sometimes and do something different.
Yeah.
And something that I haven't done before. So.
So how long did you work on The Pleasure Shock?
A long time.
Because Labor of love.
Yeah, because of different factors. Okay. First of all, the research was really difficult because this is a sort of, I'm unearthing a story that hasn't been told before. Mm-hmm. And getting in contact with people who were there in the 1950s and 60s was really difficult.
Because they're all like old now.
Or dead.
Or dead, yeah.
Mostly dead. and two of the people I actually got a hold of have since died.
Oh, wow.
So it was like, you know, the last call. And another thing, and the most important thing for taking a long time was that in the middle of all this, my boyfriend of 13 years was diagnosed with cancer and died after 6 months.
Oh, gosh.
So I took care of him, and he died, and then I had to sit down and write the book.
Yeah, that that's something you wanted to do. Yeah. You know, I can't imagine trying to. I think for some people, the grief process, like, kicks them into wanting to work to avoid or to ignore or to work through.
But I think
for some
people, what happened was just basically I had 6 months where I didn't do anything. I was just lying on my couch, not going into work, telling them, you know, give me leave without pay, and I'll be back when I can.
Yeah,
and I started to try and get the book together. Today, I can't remember how I wrote it. I cannot remember because that first year after Morten died, I can hardly remember anything. But I got it written, you know, in some way.
Oh, that's so incredible. Just such a heightened kind of emotional time in your past that, the cognitive, sometimes those things really almost cancel each other out a little bit.
I think it must have been a sort of, it was a way to get away from, you know, my life. I can sit down and write this.
Oh, and so how long ago was that now?
Oh, he died 3 years, 3 months ago. So,
Gosh, what a difficult thing that also, I mean, must inform. You must, later down the line when you reread your work, you must be able to find clues and to feel that even though it's not about him, even though probably your relationship with him and it ostensibly is in no way connected to this book, it probably informed your turn of phrase and probably informed your emotional kind
of. I'm sure it did.
Yeah.
I'm sure it did. Also, I mean, this book is a much more serious book and the prose is more serious than my previous ones, which were quite humorous. Mm-hmm. And this one definitely is more serious.
Yeah. And so in a way, it's maybe good that the content is reflective of sort of the emotional state that you were in when you were,
yeah,
when you were working on it.
Yeah.
And of course, it's serious because it's a serious topic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this book is about deep brain stimulation and kind of the good and the bad, especially in the early stages of such an creative, inventive, yet risky endeavor.
Yeah.
So why don't we talk a little bit about that? Like this, I love this aspect, and I've been talking about this a lot on the show recently. I had a guest on named Alana Mitchell, who is a Canadian science communicator and writer, who wrote about magnetism and the poles and sort of early discoveries of this quote unquote magnetic force and its relation to electricity. And we talked at length about the idea that like science really exists in a vacuum to us if we don't dive deep into the historical tales.
She's absolutely right.
Yeah, there is no science without how science came to be.
No. And it's also a very good thing to reflect about science, how it's done today, the ethics, everything. You really need to go back in time.
Mm-hmm.
You can't understand the developments and you can't understand the mechanisms of science if you don't look at the past.
Yeah.
And I think with this story, The Pleasure Shock, which is about deep brain stimulation and its, you know, hidden history, is really that when you go back, there was this guy who was doing this, you know, 50 years before everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
The time was not right for it for many reasons. Now you have it coming back. And the way that this technology is viewed now is, you know, it's all positive. It's all positive media coverage. It's hype. You know, in the future, this guy was completely vilified for doing what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the sort of the comparison between then and now and the parallels between what went on then, what is going on now are so important in order to get what, how is it science develops?
You know, I'm reminded of, and I don't think that this is a perfect analogy because as we'll start to dig deep into the historical picture, it's not quite as black and white, which nothing is.
Mm-hmm.
But right now in some of my academic pursuits, I'm studying to be a clinical psychologist. I have a neuroscience master's and then I started a PhD 10 years ago and dropped out. The time was not right. We'll see if this time it is. But I'm focusing a lot on psychometrics and on cognitive assessment right now and sort of uncovering this disgusting history of intelligence testing, where I think we tend to rewrite history and say, oh, there were some bad apples early on when intelligence testing was developed. There were some bad apples who used it for some like nefarious purposes. But ultimately, the core is no. Like the early architects, Galton, Spearman, you know, these individuals who developed these statistical techniques and developed the tests were eugenicists. They did it for a purpose. And I think sometimes when we divorce ourselves from the historical ramification, and this is, of course, a different story, but it is so important to understand the context so that we don't keep making the same mistakes. Yeah.
But also, I think it's very important when we look back, we have to, as you say, we have to understand the context.
Yes.
We have to view these people in their historical context, because it's so easy to look at somebody who did work in a different time and say, oh, that was horrible, that was unethical, how could they do this? Because that was the norm at the time.
Yeah.
And that was the view of people, that was the view of patients, so on and so forth. And I really miss that in a lot of today's debate.
Interesting. So instead of kind of saying, how could this guy possibly, we should be saying, how could we as a society have allowed this? This guy was an actor that was actually a common actor within a societal norm.
Yeah. I think that the context is really important. And there are always, you can find people that have been, you know, doing nefarious things and were not, you know, driven by the noblest of motives.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also find people who were doing what we think now is horrible, but from a different perspective.
Yeah. I mean, you see that a lot with the early lobotomy research.
Sure.
I mean, it's a great example of that. Like legitimately trying to work to cure tortuous diseases, you know, and mental health issues with the tools that we had.
Or try to invent new tools.
Yes.
And that process of inventing new tools is often what get people saying stuff like, oh, how could they do that? You know, but that's what they always do. They have people, you know, in science are on the front of things. They can't have tested it out before they actually test it out. So, you know, there's always risk.
Yeah. And a lot of what we do in science, a lot of the ways that scientists sort of interrogate reality and interrogate nature require like, oh, but if I could only extract this data, oh, well, there is no tool to allow me to do that. So first I have to invent the tool and then I can extract the data.
Yeah.
That's so much of this. And then when you start talking about biomedical science and you start talking about really the ultimate and core and kind of noble ideal here is to help people who are in pain.
Yeah.
And really that's where deep brain stimulation came about. What? Yeah. So tell me about the man on the cover of your book.
Yeah. The man on the cover of the book is Robert Galbraith Heath, who was born in Pennsylvania in 1915,
okay.
I think. And he was trained at Columbia in both psychiatry and neurology. So he had dual degrees.
And he was a medical doctor.
He was a medical doctor. And he was, you know, he was on that early team of scientists who did one of the first big investigations of lobotomies. So do they work? Mm-hmm. And how do they work? And what are the side effects? He was the evaluating psychiatrist on that project called the Columbia Greystone Project. So he actually found out and told his bosses, you know, this procedure does not seem to work on schizophrenic symptoms because these patients were schizophrenics. They were, you know, a piece of their frontal lobes were taken out. And he said, well, it doesn't seem to help the symptoms at all. It just seems to have side effects. It blunts their reactions. It blunts their affect. So he really didn't like that. And we should remember that in the 30s and 40s, lobotomies were promoted as, you know, this great and wonderful new cure for all sorts of mental illnesses. And people were lining up to have their loved ones lobotomized because, you know, oh, here is the schizophrenic brother or daughter or son. And what are we supposed to do? You know, oh, lobotomy.
And so it really had that panacea vibe, just kind of like anybody with severe mental illness, a lobotomy will work.
Yeah. And what it did was, of course, it often calmed people down because it totally blunted their emotions and their personality.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Robert G. Heath saw that this was not a way forward. And he was a visionary guy. He really wanted to do something about schizophrenia. It was his, you know, his disease. He wanted to figure out what are the causes of this. How do we cure it or at least really help these people? So he was passionate about trying to treat schizophrenia and find its causes. He was then, as a young, very promising, also very good looking and flamboyant neurologist and psychiatrist, he was headhunted by Max Lapham, who was the dean of Tulane University in New Orleans, which, and this university at this time, the late 40s, had this big ambition. We have to become the Harvard of the South. Mm-hmm. We have to do something here, and we will do it by, you know, recruiting visionary young scientists, you know, with ambition who can, you know, set something up.
Very innovative.
Yeah. They didn't have a psychiatry department at all. Mm. So they recruited Heath at the age of 34 to become their first chief of psychiatry, and he insisted, well, I'll do that, but I'll also want to be chief of neurology because I think that psychiatry and neurology belong together.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is the era when, you know, Freudianism, psychodynamics, psychoanalysis, all this bullshit, if you ask me, was still really, it was the big thing in American psychiatry. So he was out there being one of the first really serious biological psychiatrists, insisting that schizophrenia is not about your cold refrigerator mother. It's about a brain disease. We don't know what is wrong with the brain, but I have an idea. He had this idea, which came from one of his mentors, Sandor Rado, who was a Hungarian psychiatrist, actually a pupil of Freud, but very biological.
Mm-hmm.
And to him, the central sort of symptom or the core of schizophrenia was not hallucinations and that kind of stuff that we usually think of when we think of schizophrenia. No, it was anhedonia. It was the inability of the schizophrenic patient to feel, you know, positive emotion and feel pleasure. Mm. They simply don't.
Yeah.
And today that view is kind of coming back. that, you know, anhedonia is absolutely central to schizophrenia and that you have to do something about it if you want to help a person with schizophrenia. So Heath had this idea, well, we have to somehow induce the pleasure reaction, the feeling of pleasure and anhedonia in the patient. Okay. And we have to do this by going into the brain. And he was thinking about, you know, not doing it in a destructive way like lobotomy, where you actually take out a piece of the brain, but using electrodes, microelectrodes. If you can get them in there and hit a spot deep in those emotional areas where there must be something wrong, he thought, then, you know, let's try and induce the pleasure reaction and see if we can make the patient amenable to other kinds of therapy, talk and everything.
Yeah, because it seems at least ostensibly, it seems rational that if they are suffering from negative symptoms, mm-hmm. they have a blunted affect, maybe there's not enough of something in the brain. We need to stimulate it so that they can be shocked into this kind of positive.
So if you could give them that experience of pleasure, could you sort of bring them out of this, you know, schizophrenic isolation and start talking to them? And bringing them out into the world and you know, do all your therapeutic things.
And of course, this is an era of mass institutionalization. This is an era where people...
It's an era of warehousing.
Yeah. Yeah. Schizophrenics, by and large, if they were severe enough, because this is pre-Haldol, right? Yeah. If they're severe enough, they were sent off to an institution and basically fed and watered.
Yeah. And when Heath came down to New Orleans, Louisiana, in 49, he was... out there looking at, you know, the mental institutions and I mean, the people I've talked to, his, you know, some of his first colleagues who were still alive when I was there, told me about this, basically a place, you know, East Louisiana State Hospital in Jackson, which had thousands of patients warehoused under different conditions. Most were just in, you know, big wards, all sleeping together in these big, big rooms, not having any kind of therapy because they were just housed there. Mm-hmm. Then they had places like the dungeon where they actually, you know, chained people up. The worst sort of the most aggressive patients were just chained up.
Yeah, quote unquote, for their own protection.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they would sit there and they would, you know, give them a little food here and there, but basically chained like animals.
And there's still parts of sub-Saharan and West Africa where this happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, you see it, that these... because of the kind of magical thinking that's tied to it and just the lack of resources. Yeah. It's like, oh, it's for your own good.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
So this is the place that he came to at Tulane. They were affiliated with a charity hospital where he was then made responsible, of course, for the psychiatric ward. And he insisted on, you know, you guys have got to build a better ward here. You have got to build a ward with single occupancy rooms because you cannot... have patients live under these conditions.
Yeah.
And so he was, like one of his colleagues told me, he was a new broom. He came there, he wanted to do something good. He was instrumental in bettering conditions and you know, building new hospitals, psychiatric institutions. And basically he brought a really, really modern approach. He brought a team to Tulane, which had, you know, neuropsychologists, also, you know, an analyst, a Freudian analyst, and, you know, an anthropologist and a physiologist. And they all sort of worked together on this project of, can we do something with stimulating the brain? Can we help these people? And can we also find out what is the cause of schizophrenia?
So it sounds like as much as it's a really invasive and risky prospect.
Yeah.
It also was so patient-centered. It was all about welfare. It was all about improving the experience and the life of the patient.
Yeah.
Because what is the point, basically, imprisoning people who have never committed a crime?
Right, right. It was basically horrible conditions. Mm-hmm. And these were people who, you know, having somebody with schizophrenia was kind of, you know, ruinous to a lot of families.
Oh, yeah.
It was something you were... embarrassed about, and you know, people were completely unhappy. You know, my son is, you know, somebody we can never talk about, and he lives out there in Jackson somewhere. Or, you know, it was ruinous to families.
And of course, somebody who has worked so closely and who is young and sort of I guess, unencumbered by the dogma of mm-hmm. the era,
yeah.
and who has seen the difference in one way or another. And of course, this is pre, like we said, antipsychotics, but through some types of intervention, has seen the difference between an untreated and a treated schizophrenic mind.
Yeah.
And the fact that, like, this is just a person with an illness.
Yeah.
This is not a person who's possessed, and this is not a person whose constitution will never allow them to feel the basic dignity of being a human being.
Right.
Like, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And so what was sort of the, like, was the university resistant when he was like, yeah, we want to drill into their brains and zap them with electricity? Or were they like, sure, try it?
Yeah. That was his big idea that he, of course, presented when he was recruited. And that was why he was recruited. He was given, a lot of money and, you know, this whole psychiatric ward and a whole department. So the university was very much behind him all the way. And so he got in there, and in the first 2 years, he and his team did awful lot of animal studies, especially on cats, trying to figure out, they were looking at this area of the brain called the septum, which we don't call the septum anymore, but it's around where the nucleus accumbens is.
Okay.
So a central node in the reward system.
Mm-hmm.
And they were removing the septum in cats and seeing that the cats actually developed something that could be interpreted like schizophrenic symptoms. Aggression, or some of them were sort of catatonic. And so they studied the cats a lot, and they studied human anatomy, of course. And they got ready for, you know, getting patients whose families consented to this. And they got the first group of, I think it was 20 schizophrenic patients of both sexes. And
that's rare, right?
Yeah.
That era to be like, oh yeah, we'll think about gender parity in this.
No, I think it was just, it wasn't a gender parity. It was just, if you look into, there's a book, a monograph called Studies in Schizophrenia, where all the papers that, and all the studies related to this were collected, you know, a huge, thick volume. And you can see that they had different patients of, you know, different ages, both sexes, so on and so forth.
Yeah, because that's the thing about schizophrenia too, right? Is that even though there is a common age of incidence, other than that, it really is like not very selective.
Not at
all. Disease.
No, no. And so what they went for were patients who had a family environment that they could come back to.
Oh, good.
So, I mean, it wasn't, it wasn't about just getting some patients and trying this out. They were thinking about, so, are there patients that have tried everything? So electroshock therapy and you know, whatever else was out there, who have, you know, a bleak lookout, that, you know, patients that seem to be looking at, you know, a life of warehousing? And do they have social support? So a family to come back to.
Were you pleasantly surprised when you were doing this research that, because it does seem like the low-hanging fruit, and in an era where, yes, this was, what year was it?
49.
So it wasn't even post-Nuremberg yet, was it? No, it was.
It was
around the era.
Yeah.
So people were really thinking about ethics, and they were thinking about why they, but this is pre-Tuskegee. This is pre massive medical ethical
problem. Yeah.
So did it surprise you that they didn't just say, okay, let's just pick these transient, like nobody cares what we do with them and they can't consent. So whatever, it's low-hanging fruit.
The funny thing is that when I started out looking into this story, I thought that it was going to be a Tuskegee story. I thought, oh, I'm going to finally, you know, unearth this scandal and write about this horrible monster of a scientist, because that's when you look up the name Robert Heath, that's all that comes up on the
web.
It's basically, you know, all these myths about, oh, he was exploiting black patients in the deep south, and he was, you know, doing all these really scary things. And so I thought, this is what it's going to be. And then I started to look at his publications. I got those books. I started to contact people that he wrote publications with, so get in dialogue with his old co-workers. And then it dawned on me that, God, this story is not about a monster. It's a story about somebody who's been vilified and who was really a pioneer. Of course, he's not unproblematic. The ethics of that time were not unproblematic. And you would say, well, in that first group of 20 patients, one actually had a sepsis of the brain and died. And, you know, it was very risky because they didn't have stereotaxic equipment for the first, I think the first 20 patients. They developed that later. So it was a sort of, They called it the open method. They drilled a little hole and sort of stuck an electrode using, you know, visible signs in the brain. Mm-hmm. We have to get it down here and then, yeah, right by there. Fine, now we're here. And they did pneumoencephalographic studies to see, it's a kind of X-ray to see if it was in the right place. And that gave the patients, you know, humongous headaches. And it was, of course, it was risky. It was an open surgery.
But still so risky. People still periodically die from what they think of as, now DBS is like outpatient almost. I mean, it's not outpatient, but it's like, you know, it's considered common.
Yeah, and you see infections, you see bleedings.
Of course. As a quick aside, I actually co-hosted a special for National Geographic several years ago called Brain Surgery Live. And it was, you know, they wanted it to be this big kind of multinational. It's the first live brain surgery on American television. And of course, they picked a deep brain stimulation because it's relatively low risk at this point.
Yeah.
Surgery for a Parkinson's patient. But I'll tell you what, the physicians who did, I mean, the incredible surgeons who did the surgery, they prepped a second patient and had them waiting in pre-op because this was a live television event, on the off chance that he had a bleed, that he backed out, that something went wrong on the table, knowing that there is real risk involved.
Sure.
And of course, because they're incredible and because the ethics call for it, after they finish this quote unquote live, I mean, I don't know why I said quote, it was live. It's just to them, they're just doing their job. But for us, it was live. After they finished the surgery on this one gentleman, they can't leave the other person that they put in post-op or in pre-op. So we're all celebrating. Woohoo! Congrats! We did a live surgery. And they're like, got to get back to work. And they turn around and do it all over again.
Yeah.
Late at night.
Yeah.
Like, just incredible. But anyway, so now it is a much more commonplace surgery. But even now people die.
Sure.
Of course that's a risk.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, I mean, still the era where you infected patients with malaria, hoping that the fever could cure their mental illness. It was the era when you did lobotomies, outpatient, you know, hacked their brains to pieces and so on and so forth. So when I really don't think that, Robert Heath was unethical, by the standards of his time. I really don't think so.
Yeah, it sounds like he was following the Nuremberg, you know, commission, and the fact that choosing patients because they have social support and making sure that they consent.
Yeah.
I mean, I am actually pleasantly surprised that consent was part of this conversation.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, Nuremberg forced that consent is, but also these patients, if they were severe enough, might not have been able to consent on their own.
They sure weren't.
Yeah.
I mean, and the same is true today. And, and you know, there are trials today gearing up to doing the exact same deep brain stimulation in the exact same area, the nucleus accumbens, for the negative symptoms of schizophrenia.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So it's not just used for Parkinson's and pain.
Oh, no. The whole story of this book is, you know, Robert Heath started this technology in mental illness. Now it's moving from the movement disorders, dystonia, Parkinson's. It is flooding into psychiatry. And I have, you know, in the book, I visit all these people who are, you know, doing deep brain stimulation for depression, for OCD. Some are trying Tourette's. You know, they're talking about now doing it for addiction. You know, I visited a group in Gainesville who are really on the forefront of this, and they were talking about, well, we know so much about the circuits of the brain that underlie addiction of, you know, it could be drugs, it could be smoking, it could be eating, that we should start doing this. I mean, stimulating brains to get rid of addiction.
Yeah.
And that's brain surgery for, you know, stop smoking.
Yeah. Oh, wow. And it's so fascinating, too, that like it was so prescient at the time for him to want to kind of combine psychiatry and neurology. And even Freud was a neurologist, you know, it sort of built out of that.
I mean, Freud wanted to be a biological, you know, brain scientist, but he couldn't because the tools weren't there.
Yeah.
So he, you know, became the father of psychology.
Yeah, so he developed psychoanalysis because at the time that seemed reasonable to him. But of course, it's interesting that they've followed this parallel track. And even today, neurology and psychiatry remain really siloed in a way that, like, I mean, I do think we're at the forefront of like a kind of reemergence of multidisciplinary studies, and neuropsychology, for example, is a really big burgeoning field. But I mean, the fact that, he was coalescing these things at a time when
and I think I write this in the book, that he was actually very, you know, holistic in a way. He believed in, you know, it is the brain and the mind. So you can't just treat the brain. He wasn't one of these people who like a lot of psychiatrists now with a biological view of things will say, you know, eat that pill or, you know, get that electrode, whatever it is. It's just a biological thing. The mind is also, you know, you change the mind and affect the mind by, you know, talking and doing other things, your behavior, everything. So he believed very much in, you know, getting the whole palate in there.
Yeah, that
biological, you know, treatment perhaps, but also, you know, talking to patients and doing this, that, and the other, occupational therapy, all that stuff. And that's what everybody I talked to said. He was a brilliant clinician. Mm-hmm. And he had a lot of high status patients in New Orleans. They all came mm-hmm. to him because he was a really good clinician and a, you know, somebody who could get to people.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick moment to thank the sponsors of this week's episode, starting with Audible. Now, you listen to Talk Nerdy because you love to learn, and there's no better way to learn than through reading. But sometimes it's, you know, inconvenient. We don't have the time, or we're stuck in places where we can't read with our eyes, but we can read with our ears. And Audible is offering you, the Talk Nerdy audience, a free audiobook with a 30-day free trial. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. You've just got to go to audible.com/Kara or text Kara to 500-500. And you can browse their unmatched selection of audio content and download a free title to start listening. It is that easy. Millions of Audible members access performances by entertainers, they access magazines and amazing narrators of their favorite books. Now, I've got one to recommend this week, of course. What do you think it is? It's the book we've been talking about this whole episode, Lona Frank and The Pleasure Shock. It's available right now on Audible. It's narrated by Cassandra Campbell. It's about 8 hours and 45 minutes. So, you know, I can't think of anything better to listen to while you're in the gym, while you're on the train. Maybe you're about to take a road trip. And there are so many cool features in Audible. There's speed control, so you can listen faster or slower and pick narration at the speed that really does suit you. There's whisper sync for voice so that you can switch back and forth between reading and listening across multiple devices like Amazon's Kindle and Echo without ever losing your place or missing a word. And of course, your books are yours to keep. With Audible, you can go back and re-listen anytime, even if you cancel your membership. So guys, get a free audiobook with a 30-day free trial at audible.com/Kara or text Kara to 500-500. That's audible.com/Kara or text Kara to 500-500. I also want to thank the Great Courses Plus for their support of Talk Nerdy. Guys, while we're on the theme of talking about learning, continuing to learn even later in life, even if you're out of school, let's talk a little bit about the Great Courses Plus. It is a fantastic streaming service, and I'm so excited for you guys to try it. You get unlimited access to learn from the world's top professors and experts in any category you can think of: science, math, history, art, music, even cooking, photography. Guys, there are thousands of video lectures and audio lectures to choose from, and you can watch or listen whenever you want. I recommend starting with a course that I loved, The Inexplicable Universe by Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. He dives into the heart of some of science's greatest mysteries: black holes, extraterrestrial life, multiple universes, the kinds of things that blow your mind. There is so much to discover with the Great Courses Plus. And as one of my listeners, you will get a free trial to watch or listen to any of these fantastic lectures. But you've got to go to my special URL. Sign up for your free trial at thegreatcoursesplus.com/nerdy. Remember, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/nerdy. All right, guys, let's get back to the show.
And I wonder how common was kind of a biopsychosocial approach back then? Because I think of it as quite a modern
It is
view.
Quite modern. And a lot of what I have seen, and the thing is with you know, all his stuff, it's not really known. Mm. I mean, like, when you look at books, the history of psychiatry, he's never there.
Yeah.
He's never there. And I'm like, why not?
He was this, like, other
yeah.
in their mind.
He's been sort of, everything has been swept under the rug, but he was actually doing this really out there, new work at this early time. And of course, what he also did was very ahead of his time. He filmed all his treatments, his experiments.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And all those films are at Tulane University. They won't let anyone see them.
Oh.
I was so lucky to, I got in contact with Heath's son, Robert Jr., and he found all these films, copies of all these films in their summer house, which is, by the way, called Hedonia. And so he sent them to me.
Oh, wow.
So I've actually seen all these films that the university wouldn't let me see.
And so did it, in watching them, were you like, now I see why they won't let me see it? Or were you like, what are they upset about?
It was the opposite. It was like, wow, this is, you know, there are all these rumors about, oh, he would look into trying to figure out the brain circuits of, you know, pleasure and also of pain and memory. So he would stimulate in different areas of the brain. And look at, so what is the reaction of the patient? And then talk to them about it. So he had, for example, a patient who had trouble because of psychomotor epilepsy. Mm-hmm. He had trouble with, you know, uncontrollable rages. And so he was talking about these rages and an aberrant activity showed up in one brain area. And later they would try to stimulate that brain area. And what happened? He gets this violent fit. In, you know, in the middle of the session. And afterwards, again, they sit there and talk about, so were these feelings just like what you, you know, run into when you, you know, get mad at your sister for something and want to strangle her or whatever. And so it's very much a collaboration between him and the patients.
Which is like incredible because, I mean, thinking at least about motor disorders, they do that now when they're, you know, they've done an exploratory analysis, but yes, they'll probe and say, okay, let's look at your tremors here and no, not quite there. Yeah. Okay. Let's move it. And I mean, that's just commonplace now.
Yeah.
We think of that as like, well, of course, but back then, especially talking to the patient.
Sure.
Because I mean, even 20 years ago, medicine was still incredibly patriarchal.
Oh, sure.
Like it was paternalistic. The patient had no say.
Yeah.
It was like, we know what's best for you. Yeah. I am old white man in lab coat.
Yeah. And that was what it was like then. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just a few bad apples here and there. No, that was medicine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they were all like that. Mm-hmm. And they were brought up to be like that.
They were taught that patients don't know. That's why they're sick.
And like, patients also wanted it at that time. Mm-hmm, they weren't lining up saying, hey, come on, don't be paternalistic. You know, I can make my own decisions. No, they went to the doctor and said, what are we going to do? Do something.
Yeah.
You know.
Help me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. That's incredible. So did you talk to anybody at Tulane in their library science department or the people who are sort of the arbiters, the keepers of these tapes after you had seen them?
Yes.
To say like, why are you preventing, like there's nothing in here to be worried about.
I hadn't seen them at that point. I was there and I talked to, you know, the top people in the psychiatry department and trying to convince them, you know, I'm not out to do this sensationalist reporting. I want to see those films because I think they're a historical document.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this, you know, you can't hide behind the HIPAA law saying, oh, there are patients on there. Yeah, but they're anonymous. They're called B this or A that.
Oh, interesting. And probably lots of them are dead, so that doesn't apply.
They're probably
anyway.
All dead.
Yeah, exactly.
And anyway, so I think that the academics I talked to were very much in favor, but then the lawyers just told them, no, you know, let's close this down here. And that's it.
Just too much liability.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes you wonder if they've ever seen the tapes.
The lawyers probably haven't.
Yeah.
No, I talked to them over Skype, I remember. And they seemed like they had no idea what deep brain stimulation was anyway. It's just, you know.
They're just like, we can't.
They were just asking, so are there patients on there? Yes. Yeah. There are patients on there, but you can't really see who it is. And this is very old footage. They're all dead. Mm-hmm. You know. Oh, but there are patients on there. Okay. And so, you know.
Did you ever get the chance, you know, because I think it does bring up, like you said, early on, maybe you had maybe not a hope, but an expectation, an interest that like, I'm going to uncover some, you know, ethical violations. And I'm
One of those traditional stories that you really want to break as a journalist,
exactly,
right?
Because of course, I think that our expectation has become that we were not good to people historically, that Tuskegee was in some ways the rule, not the exception. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we see like Rebecca Skloot's story about Henrietta Lacks. Like, right. That becomes sort of a template in our minds.
Yeah.
Did you have the opportunity to ever connect with the families of the patients who got these deep brain surgeries?
The problem was, of course, that I didn't have any names of patients.
Because they wouldn't give them to you.
No.
Yeah.
I found one patient who's still alive.
Wow.
Who was operated on, had a brain pacemaker, as they call it at that point, put in 1976. By then, Heath had developed this brain pacemaker that you didn't have to go deep into the brain. You could actually put it on the vermis of the cerebellum.
Oh, wow.
Which is, I mean, much easier.
Yeah.
And so he operated on this boy. He was 17 years old. And I have seen the films where he's making sure that the parents of this patient know that this is a experimental procedure, what it entails, would they still choose it for their son? And, you know, it's all there. It's consenting.
And was he schizophrenic?
No, he was actually called the most violent mental patient in Louisiana.
Whoa.
Nobody knew what was wrong with him, but he had been out of control, really violent, like homicidal from he was a kid.
But they definitely saw it as a mental illness and not just as a, this is an evil person, quote unquote.
His school teachers would say he was an evil boy. His parents were really, you know, trying everything they could. But what happened was that by the age of 17, he was hospitalized. He had been for a couple of years. They just drugged him and chained him to the bed.
Yeah.
So I met with him and his sister. And so what happened when he got this brain pacemaker was that they could control the rages. They went away. And he was, in a way, his own control, because at one point, the wires broke, and he immediately reverted to that aggressive phenotype.
Even after, like, he had gone through some developmental changes.
Yeah. And then they fixed it. He was back to being, you know, normal. And I met with him outside of New Orleans and with his sister. And I also met with the surgeon who originally put in the pacemaker. And the really, really strange thing that happened was that, you know, the surgeon was there with me and we were testing, you know, is this brain pacemaker still working after 40 years? And he said, yeah, it is. I mean, he did some kind of radio testing. He could pick up the signals from it. And David, the patient at one point sort of went, you know, to the side with the surgeon and said, well, I don't know, but I feel like, you know, there's something in me that's not right.
Mm.
And, you know, nobody thought anything of it. And, you know, we said goodbye. And then a week later, he snapped and completely, you know, he snapped at somebody he lived with and beat him up and was hospitalized. And it turned out the battery had run out.
Wow. And he was and feeling like low on juice.
Yeah.
Jeez.
And so this old surgeon of, you know, he's now 93, went in there and changed the battery. And changed everything.
It's incredible, too, because you said that this was placed in his cerebellum. It's not even like a limbic.
But the thing is that Heath figured out at one point using monkeys that he studied that there are fibers, there are paths from the cerebellum to the limbic system.
I see.
And so
so
you can affect the limbic system. And that was another, I mean, he was a good theorist. He was really good with anatomy. Mm-hmm. So he figured this out and he tried it out on this patient. And later, several patients during the 70s, I think he operated on another 15 or 16 people who had this brain pacemaker put in on the cerebellum.
For emotional problems.
Yeah, some for depression and some for schizophrenia. And I've seen that in films work really well on some of these schizophrenic patients who have rage problems.
Do you think that there's something about just, first of all, the increase in population, second of all, the increase in you know, the good things that come from wealth and improvements in the economy, that there are just more people who are educated and there are more people that are specialized, that what you end up with is a culture where people have such specific skills that almost you don't see this type of, oh, I'm a researcher and a physician anymore. I'm going to do the experiments and then turn around and see the patients through and work with them through.
Yeah.
It feels kind of like a bygone profession.
It does. I mean, specialization is is good for many things. Mm-hmm. It's also not so good for some things. And I have, you know, as a science writer, I've written about this an awful lot of times with regard to cancer, for example. Mm. I mean, cancer research is, you know, making strides. But a lot of it is not percolating down to patient care. Because the doctors, the oncologists, don't know about it or are, you know, way behind and, oh, I'm not going to subject my patients to something that hasn't been tested and this, that, and the other. So there's a giant time lag from the things that you know, cancer researchers are figuring out to when it actually reaches patients.
I was blown away the other day when I did a story on my other podcast on Skeptics Guide about what happens if you put your head in a particle accelerator, because one dude accidentally did it at CERN, or maybe it was back at Fermilab. Mm-hmm. I think it was at Fermilab. And then, like, the more I've read about it, the more I learned about, like, nuclear medicine and the idea that basically we have these, like, cancer treatments that are mini particle accelerators. Like,
sure. And they always were.
Like, that's like a legit option for people who have a very particular type of tumor. And I was like, how did I literally just not know about this?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it makes me wonder how many patients have things that are available that unless they go to a really sophisticated cancer treatment center where, like you said, there are specialists from all those different areas under one roof.
Sure, if you go to Sloan Kettering or you know, some center like that,
but if you
get
live
the best
in a
treatment.
Rural area and you see, like, you're lucky if there's an oncologist on staff. Then,
sure. Yeah.
It's I mean, it's fascinating to me that sort of the PhD MD is now this kind of ideal that almost nobody, it's just almost impossible to do that with your life, to get to that place. I have a couple friends that are MD PhDs, and it's just like, you are superhuman. You never sleep.
Yes.
You never, but the fact that, like, everybody was a researcher practitioner back in the day, because you had to be, it's the only way you could actually treat patients.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
I think there ought to be more experimentation. I mean, of course, careful experimentation.
Yeah, ethical experimentation.
Yeah, but that's how you get somewhere.
Yeah.
Really.
And so, you know, in kind of changing your perspective and your opinion based on, you know, sort of what you went in with a preconceived expectation and then what you gained and what you learned, almost like improving this principle of charity as you're moving on in this study, is there anything by the end of putting together this this book, and by the end of doing all of your reporting for the book, you came away with, like, were there any sort of closing thoughts or maybe surprising experiences that you had that you felt like, it's really important for me to share this because I don't want people to misunderstand?
I think that really the whole thing was, like, I was thinking all along, you know, I bet when I, you know, have this new angle on this new interpretation of this controversial person, it's going to be really hard in America, because there is this tendency here to really want to see anything about psychiatry in the past as bad.
Yeah.
Really bad, really black chapter. And actually saying that, let's take another look at this and get beyond those automatic reactions is going to be hard. And I just saw proof of that. I mean, there was a great review, very positive review in Nature.
Okay.
Then there was this horrible review in the Wall Street Journal where a sociologist, they had asked a sociologist who has made his career out of, you know, writing critical books about early psychiatry to review this book.
Sure.
And of course, he thought it was horrible.
And they may have thought ostensibly, like, oh, it's going to be another one of those books because that's what we read all
probably
the time, because it's salacious.
Yeah. And it was so clear when you read that review that he went into it with, you know, the notion that Robert Heath is one of those bad guys. And since I didn't say that, you know, he calls me all these names and, you know, it's the most unfair review I've ever seen.
Which is really unfortunate because, it goes against journalistic principles to not walk in with an open mind and try and, like, learn as you go. But it also, if this person really is a sociologist, it goes against scientific principles because
it does. I think it's actually embarrassing for an academic.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows absolutely nothing about deep brain stimulation.
Yeah.
And so he calls me credulous for thinking that deep brain stimulation is a technology that will work.
Come on, guy. It already works. Mm. Like, it's been working for decades.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. But it is so neat to see the kind of the meandering sort of roads of history, how sometimes there are ideas that are incredibly brilliant and we call them prescient now only because they were too ahead of their time.
Yeah.
There wasn't the sociological support for it. And also maybe there were just certain aspects of technology that we didn't quite have yet.
Sure.
You know, we didn't, it's like with antidepressants, for example, sometimes they don't work. Sometimes they work really well. And we have no idea why.
There are clues to genetic factors. Mm-hmm. And that also explains a lot about why the trials are not working out very well. It seems that there are groups of patients for whom it works really well and groups of patients for whom it doesn't really work. Yeah, because they have different genetics. So it's very much about figuring out who is the test population you should test this on.
Yes.
Before you go in.
And looking after the fact and saying, you know, because this is the standard of care. Mm-hmm. Just because we don't fully understand mechanistically what's going on doesn't mean that this treatment is not viable.
Right. And the funny thing is, when you talk about depression, we heard for years and years and years, oh, it's all about low serotonin. Mm-hmm. No, mm-hmm. that hypothesis was never, ever, you know, close to being proven. It has probably nothing to do with low serotonin. Nobody's ever measured serotonin in depressives contra, you know, versus non-depressives.
And only a certain percentage of antidepressants are SSRIs.
Sure. And the way they work, I mean, they work after weeks. Mm-hmm. So what is that delay about? It's not about serotonin. It's probably about something completely, it's an epiphenomenon, perhaps. Maybe it's about, you know, neurogenesis, a lot of other things. So we still, I mean, after, as, you know, some of these old guys I talked to, psychiatrists who are 90 years old said, you know, we really haven't moved very much forward in psychiatry between the 50s and now. We don't know much more. We have, you know, better drugs, but we don't know much more.
Psychology, too. I mean, as I'm studying the university that I go to, like many clinical psychology programs, there are theoretical orientations that you sort of attach yourself to and they inform your approach. And there are still, I mean, I'm not psychoanalytic by any stretch. And I will give a little bit of props to the fact that like modern psychoanalysts are not typically Freudian. They even call themselves psychodynamic because they don't want to be associated with it.
Good idea.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't identify with that. But the fact that it has such a strong hold still is fascinating to me.
Freud affected our culture more than, you know, many, 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 many other real scientists that I can think of. Yeah. It's amazing. We actually live in a Freudian culture.
We do. Mm-hmm. And it's a big eye roll to skeptics.
Yes, it is.
I'm glad we agree. Well, Lona, this has been a fascinating chat. And I would be remiss if I said goodbye without closing it out the same way I close out every episode. I know you got a little bit of a preview of that because you came in while I was finishing another recording. But if you're okay with it, I would love to ask you the same two questions I ask all my guests.
Sure.
Great. So I want you to think about the future and I want you to think about it in whatever context is relevant to you. It could be personal, you know, your work, your life, or it could be, you know, communal or global.
Hmm.
And the first question is, what is the thing that really keeps you up the most at night? What is the thing that is kind of maybe the most negative, pressing, kind of concerning thing that you are struggling with? But then on the flip side of that, so that we don't end on too low a note, what are you hopeful and optimistic about?
I think what keeps me up at night, if anything, I'm not an alarmist really, but when I look at the world, I think that one thing I notice is, and we live in a time when there is so much opportunity for personal freedom because of, you know, our ideology, the way the world is, at least in the West. But people are so unfree. I mean, it's as if, you know, our cultures are restricting freedom. You could look at, you know, the Muslim world. You see a kind of reversion to older forms of you know, more fundamentalist religion, which is, you know, it's horrible. It's appalling. And you could look at the West. I mean, what's happening here? We live in this society where we could basically do and be what we want. And what do? We figure out ways of restricting each other's freedom. Mm-hmm. Like just the whole concept, and which is most prevalent in this country, I think, with know, you go to colleges, which are all about academic freedom. You have safe spaces. You have trigger warnings. You have this, that, and the other. You have identity politics. It really riles me up. Come on, guys. I am not, you know, pro-discrimination of anyone. I think anyone should be free to do and be and call themselves whatever they want.
Yeah.
But they should not impose on society to, you know, oh, you can only, you have to do this or make these concessions for this little group or that little group. No, we all have to be personally strong and go out there and be who we are. And so this identity politics, to me, it makes people, you know, weak. You know, it makes them, in my eyes, weak to say, oh, you have to really be careful when you talk about me or my kind, or you have to do this or that. No, we should all just go out there, be who we are. And if somebody says something to you, you know, go up against them, do something. But don't, this whole political movement of everybody should really be careful with what they say and what they do. That is just taking away, you know, our freedom.
Do you think, it's funny, I'm going to push back a little because that's what I do. Do you think that, you know, especially because you, as you mentioned, which I completely agree with, this seems to be a sort of not completely, but a sort of uniquely American phenomenon because we have such, and I am remiss to admit that I don't know much about the Danish sort of historical context of marginalized groups, but we have such a deep history of disenfranchisement in our country of minority groups, that what this really is an awakening to the fact that the playing field is not level. And because I fundamentally agree with you that we should have ultimate freedom to do and say and act how we want to, so long as it doesn't infringe on the rights of others.
Right.
And I think once we butt up against that infringement, so safe spaces in colleges, I agree. Bullshit.
Yeah.
But also, I do think that freedom of discriminatory speech is one thing, but freedom of discriminatory action is not, for example, because at that point you are actually infringing on the rights of others.
But then you have laws in place, I hope.
We do, but we also have institutional racism, which is terrible. So we have laws in place that actually maintain the status quo for the white majority,
but I think that the whole thing is looking at it, you know, politically and looking at it. So are the right laws in place? If everybody's intention, and everybody's intention seems to be, you know, we should have an equal society. We are working on this. Yes, you have a, you know, crazy president at the moment, but he will be out at some point.
Yeah. Historically, we've had a lot of like regressive white men who are actually writing the laws. And that's the problem, right? Is that these minority groups who are disenfranchised don't have political power.
But, you know, rise up as political groups and demand these laws and get them written. Fine. But don't make it into, you know, questions of what people can do and say in their private arenas or in the street or whatever. I think it really, it only breeds, you know, resentment.
It does. And I think it is a threat. I think sometimes, unfortunately, it's a reaction of it's all that certain marginalized individuals can do because they don't have political power.
But what, I mean, we could look at history.
Yeah.
For example, you know, the gay rights movement. It was terrible. It was terrible to be gay in, say, the 30s or 40s in most countries, including this one.
Yeah.
And at some point, people got enough of that. And, you know, you can be gay today. You can be openly gay and have any sort of, you know, work, job, position, you know, here and in Europe. And it's fine. And what they did was actually, yes, they rose up. They, you know, went out there, did something about it, made themselves visible and, you know, appropriated all this, you know, bad talk about gay people.
Yeah.
Like even the words using, you know, oh yeah, I'm a raving queen, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
They just turned everything against their oppressors and they have succeeded. So
I wouldn't say they've succeeded, but I would say that they're in a better position than they were. And that's where I think we disagree. Yeah, because I think that even though, sure, we're at a place where there are gay rights in place, they're constantly trying to be repealed. And ultimately, there are certain gay rights that have been repealed. There are certain people who still can't get married. There are certain people who still don't have the right to make medical decisions about their partners. You know, so we are still fighting against that. Like, I worry that
the view of the fact that America is sort of a post-regressive society is a little premature. And that's where, as a social justice quote-unquote warrior, which people use as a pejorative against me, I'm proud to kind of to work towards that. So, but I also think these kinds of intellectual debates are important because it's a nuanced issue.
Yeah.
It's nuanced. And I agree, like, the last thing you want to do is restrict the rights of another to protect the rights of somebody else. So it's about walking that fine line so that, and this speaks to the core of like governmental philosophy. This is like some Plato and like some Locke and some pain shit that most people don't even study in school, which frustrates me.
Yeah.
It really frustrates me that you can get through an undergraduate degree in this country, maybe in other countries as well, having like literally never talked about these core philosophical concepts.
I mean, sometimes when you look at school systems, both here and in other countries, you say, but what do they learn?
I know, right? I agree. So, okay, let's flip the script. What are you really like excited and optimistic about?
Whoa, that's a difficult one.
Are you working on a new book yet? Do you have a new kind of venture in your mind?
I'm actually working on a documentary about this, the pleasure shock,
which
is, it is fascinating. And it's a very visual story.
Sure, with all the archival, like footage.
Yeah.
And things.
If we can get permission for that. Yes. but optimistic. I think if I were to be optimistic on behalf of the world and the situation, I think I would have to say, you know, we're in some ways in a downturn, you know, politically and, you know, globally politically. And at some point there has to be an up. It's like history is not this eternally progressive thing.
I mean, sometimes progress only happens because of oppression, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a reaction often. Mm-hmm. And I think there will be a reaction at some point. And hopefully things in like the Middle East and other places will get better because that is really a horrible situation.
And I see it as a warning sign to, for example, some of the identity politics that you see here.
Exactly.
That like, as people start to realize that their own individual rights are being stripped away, they will react. Yeah.
That's what I hope.
Yeah. And I think it's, if I were a betting woman, which I am, because I love poker, I would say that it's a good bet because historically that is like the arrow does trend in the direction of progress, but it's not a straight line.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So upwards and onwards.
Well, gosh, this was such a fascinating chat. Thank you so much for taking the time and first of all, for writing this incredible book. Guys, you can buy it right now. It's available wherever books are sold. Whether you like to go to your local bookstore or just pick it up on Amazon, there's a link in the show notes. It's called The Pleasure Shock, The Rise of Deep Brain Stimulation and Its Forgotten Inventor by Lona Frank. Lona, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, and everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.